And we have some handouts that I typed up thinking that you might enjoy reading it on your own if you haven't. Now, I know Linda is from Anand Tupton, and Linda is Anand Tupton's student. And he wrote a great, he has a great book here called Choosing Compassion. And when I was rooting around trying to find readings for this, besides the one that says Pema, this chapter just leapt out at me, and I will want to talk about that. It's the chapter called Thank You to Life. And then again, my husband recommended a chapter in this book by Zigar Kongtrul. The book is called Light Comes Through, and the pages are called, it begins, Guilty as Charged, A Case Against Jealousy, and moves into The Practice of Rejoicing, which is how he discusses working with joy as a practice. And in fact, that clearly is how we as practitioners can start working with clearing ourselves out of the center of everything that happens. Another thing Zigar Kongtrul says, and I think we maybe ought to go around the room and read a little bit of, and read those, that chapter. If you, it's not very long. And actually, we're going to hand this out and we're going to read this.
Okay. Okay, so you want me to hand this out now?
Whatever. Oh, look what you did.
Get the school teacher one.
I know, and she helped me with this, and here I am, changing the plan.
That's how teaching works.
I'm so joyful. So how can we stop being so, you know, this practice, which we've been doing, some of us, for a very long time, and we've heard from the very beginning, is, again, how you are not the center of the universe, and how our compulsion to measure everything against how we feel about it and what we want is the antithesis of actually being beneficial to ourselves and anybody else. But it's not something just because you hear it, you get it. In fact, you hear it again and again and again and forget it again and again and again. And the emotions and fear and the whole ball of wax interferes constantly with our mission of being of some sort of benefit. Hopefully. At least after we've made a certain, made a certain amount of progress on the path. And we see we're not the only ones who are suffering. And our hearts open up and we want to be of some benefit. So, but here we are, stuck with ourselves. But the beauty of that is just like the beauty of when you're on the cushion and you're doing, say, shamatha meditation, and all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, thinking of the best things you could have said, the conversation that happened last night, and why the hell didn't you say that, and you're, and here you're trapped again and again, and you're hooked again, and then you go, oh, I was supposed to be following my breath. Well, that's good news. in the sense that it gets you back to actually following your breath. And you can see that you were thinking, you can see that you got hooked, you can see that you weren't a criminal. It wasn't a criminal act. But it's actually a great thing because it gets you back on track. So the same thing as the same thing with joy, working with the practice of joyousness, because it presupposes that you're able to experience joy that is based on more than just making yourself feel good. So this isn't so circuitous. We're actually back to our understanding of getting ourselves out of the way and actually being able to make connection. To experiencing joy joy at others' good news, at others' something wonderful has happened to them. And I find once you start working with the awareness that this isn't a world meant just for me, and the only way it's going to work is if I'm happy. And in this group, we've been discussing the sense of knowing that everybody wants to be happy, working with the sense that everybody, that you recognize that people are just like you. People are wanting to experience some kind of satisfaction and happiness in their life. So you get offered the opportunity to work with this practice of rejoicing over and over and over again. You get offered the opportunity when that asshole cuts in front of you in traffic. And you get to say, good, you can get to the... You're stressed because you need to get someplace. And obviously, that's, you know, you don't have to in a race. You can actually experience joy that somebody got the parking spot that you wanted. That, in fact, last piece of cake that you looked really good. It's gone, and somebody else is really happy, and in fact, as you get older, and I think getting older is a really important part of it, you experience the sense that not only is this not your world meant for you only, but you start feeling satisfaction at other people's happiness, at other people's accomplishments, which is where this wonderful chapter of jealousy comes in. And so we should do that, because I think we should read that. Zeigarkongtrul's approach and Anand Thubten's approach to the subject come from different angles, and they're not overall, they're the same, they're equal, but the approaches are very different. And I think in a way Anand Thubten's approach is much more geared at recognizing the temporariness of our own existence, how impermanent we are, and therefore how precious it is that we experience everything in this life, whether we find it pleasing or not pleasing. And that's in the handout, which I hope you will read. But we can talk about that as well. And Zeigar Controls is much more about working with your emotions in a sort of interactive way. So would you be willing to read this as a group?
Sure.
Okay, and we'll pass this around. And if you, everybody read a paragraph.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Guilty as charged, a case against jealousy. Buddhist texts traditionally list the 5 disturbing emotions, beginning with attachment and then move on to aggression, stupidity, jealousy, and arrogance. But here I'd like to start with jealousy because it is the most obvious, ridiculous, and embarrassing of all the emotions, which makes it easier to overcome. If we practice working with jealousy first, we'll have more confidence in working with the subtlety of the other emotions later.
The jealous mind wants what others have, be it physical attributes, wealth, intelligence, someone else's spouse, their job status, spiritual accomplishments, and so on. Because it focuses on what it doesn't have, it feels impoverished and discontent all the time. When we are possessed by jealousy, it is as if something were lacking in our very existence, something someone else has. Jealousy is a comparative dynamic that causes us to resent others. We resent their positive attributes and continuously search for their weaknesses. Why do they possess those attributes that should belong to me?
The jealous mind is gross and powerful. Not only do we lose respect for ourselves when we feel jealous, but everyone else. But everyone else loses respect for us too. We feel exposed like a worm whose rock has been overturned. As much as we want to hide, we lose face. In this way, the grossness of jealousy has some value. Nothing is hidden, so we can see it and then try to overcome it, or at least have a good laugh.
Of all the emotions, jealousy is the most crass and easy to identify, because comparing with others is what jealousy likes to do best. Let's compare jealousy with the other negative emotions to see how we can identify with it. One could easily argue that aggression, not jealousy, is the grossest emotion of all, because aggression often expresses itself with intensity. But aggression can be subtle. We can easily convince ourselves that we have good reason to be angry. It takes a much deeper and subtler level of strength and conviction and nonviolence to give up aggression completely. Attachments are deep-rooted, and there are so many of them. Furthermore, our attachments are so often mixed with caring feelings and pleasure that we find it difficult emotionally to even entertain the thought of giving them up. The arrogant mind is more slippery than jealousy. We often mistake arrogance for the strength that keeps us from buckling under our weaknesses. There is a fine line between arrogance and self-confidence. And last but not least is stupidity. Stupidity is the hardest emotion to detect of them all, because our minds are so shrouded in habitual patterns. It sits on the sidelines, never questioning anything, so the whole mechanism of jealousy just keeps operating. But with jealousy, what you see is what you get. It can't even maintain a false sense of self-esteem like all the other emotions can.
Beneath all of this crassness is the self-cherishing ego, backing jealousy up every step of the way. But at the same time, ego doesn't approve. Jealousy is just too embarrassing. Ego tries to reject the idea that such a thing could possibly be part of its stainless mental stream. Ego's reaction is like someone getting drunk and acting stupid at an office party and then trying to back up their foolish conduct with logic and reason the next morning at work. It just doesn't go over. When we interrogate it, jealousy breaks down before it reaches the witness stand, guilty as charged.
Keep going.
The please. Practice of rejoicing.
Yes, exactly.
The practice of rejoicing. Okay, we confess. Jealousy is clumsy, and not only because it assaults our sense of vanity. We have to admit that it causes pain. It prevents us from appreciating our own life and gets in between our relationships with others in an unwholesome way. But to stop here would not be enough. Like all emotions, jealousy is habitual, which means that even though we have investigated the harm it can do and the merits of overcoming it, even if we are completely convinced, it will still rise up again out of habit. What we need now is a very strong antidote, and the antidote to jealousy is the practice of rejoicing.
Rejoicing is simply feeling happy when something fortunate or beneficial happens to someone other than ourselves. Imagine going to a football match. Everyone cheers for their team. If someone makes a goal, the whole team jumps up and down and hugs each other. Sometimes they carry the player that scored on their shoulders. Even the most macho guy on the team has tears in his eyes. Everyone in the stands rises up, yelling and waving flags, elated, rejoicing because of this player's accomplishment. This person's accomplishment has become their accomplishment too.
We can find so many ways to rejoice and so many things to rejoice in. Rejoicing practice is like this, a little bit of labor, but much merit. In other words, we simply share in the joy of others' virtue, which is a virtuous act in itself. When someone becomes a vegetarian or donates money to a charitable organization, we can rejoice. We can rejoice in the virtue of people who have put their life on the line to help others. The Good Samaritan we hear about on the news. We can rejoice in the spiritual accomplishments of others too. We can rejoice in the realization of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and in the liberation of the Arahats.
We can also rejoice in the beauty of the world and the fact that others have the merit to enjoy it. We can rejoice when the sun comes up in the morning and warms an entire valley and all the beings in it, or when the rain falls, providing water for the crops. We can rejoice in the physical ability of others, that a bird can fly or that a fish can swim, things that we can only imagine doing ourselves. A friend of mine was in a car accident and injured his neck. He suffered a great deal from this and couldn't move about freely. One day he was watching a flock of swans swimming in a lake on TV. He noticed how agile their necks were, how they moved about with so much ease, grace, and flexibility. And without even thinking about it, he began to rejoice in their freedom of movement. At that moment, he experienced a great sense of joy that took him beyond the concerns he had for his own condition.
We need to ask ourselves, why does it always have to be my joy? Why is it so hard to delight in the joy of others? Why, after sitting in front of the TV version of things, after sitting in front of the TV version of how things should be, do we need to think, why isn't it like that for me? We feel deprived when we indulge in this kind of comparison. We feel like we're missing out on the cheese all the goodies in this world has to offer. These days there is so much competitiveness, people feel squeezed and impoverished no matter how much they have. This is because there is no inner sense of richness. Ages ago, one gold coin would make someone feel rich. Now even $1 million won't do. Children have a room full of toys but get easily bored. We can remedy all this through the practice of rejoicing. Generally, we love praise when it comes in our direction. We rejoice in every occasion we can of being happy with ourselves. But when we have the chance to be happy for others, why reject that? We say, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, and love thy neighbor. Furthermore, some of us take the Bodhisattva vow to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So how do we justify getting irritated when others obtain a little bit of happiness, a little bit of accomplishment, in this world where happiness is so ephemeral and so hard to obtain? We should feel relieved in the same way parents feel relieved when their children are able to stand on their own 2 feet.
The mean-spiritedness of jealousy will not lead anyone to enlightenment. The logic of jealousy exposes all our stupidity and shows the inconsistency in our thinking. So consider the practice of rejoicing. It removes any trace of I, me, and mine from our mind streams. When we rejoice in the well-being of others, we break free of that subtle self-absorption that threatens us from the inside. We will no longer be willing to get knocked down by jealousy, that ridiculous emotion. We'll begin to see the freeing effects of rejoicing and the blessing of it. Positivity of rejoicing practices releases us within us the qualities of intelligence, selflessness, generosity, patience, strength, and good-heartedness. How can we feel the pain of jealousy in the midst of this abundance of good qualities?
Obviously, this is something that we won't make any sense to us unless we have the liberating experience that comes from the actually rejoicing ourselves. In the beginning stages of counteracting jealousy, we may need to force the practice of rejoicing upon it. Of course, we need good reasons for doing this. Otherwise, we won't get motivated. Many people might find the idea of forcing to be artificial. Unfortunately, to go with what comes naturally to us usually means falling prey to our emotions, so we need to apply a strong remedy by modifying our behavior, which in turn modifies our thoughts and emotions. We use this practice to deliberately shape the mind to work for us.
This is cultivating wealth through pennies?
No, we're good.
We're joyful.
We should have a discussion about this, but I just wanted to add that when I began this talking to Jen, I mentioned that I was sick for a long time this fall. So it's very interesting myself sitting there dealing with my own frustration at what I couldn't do. And illness, it's possible that all of us have experienced some pretty rough situations. Resisting that is the opposite of the practice of joy. Somehow working with experiencing well-being in the center, in the middle of not being given not being who you think you are, not being given the attributes that you think belong to you, is actually an amazing practice. And that's an extreme view of it. There's also that when you step out of a shower and the room is cold, and you could go, oh, this is so cold and terrible, or you could rejoice in the bite of that air on your skin and how alive you are and how brilliant that is. And in the middle of being depressed about something, you notice this big, beautiful moon in the sky, mm-hmm. or you see the face of a friend. The world is constantly poking us to wake up to this joy. None of us is permanent. We're clearly temporary. We don't have a lot of time to waste complaining and bitching about stuff. But what we do have is we've allowed ourselves to become practitioners and to become aware that we can work with everything that's landed in our lives as our path. And joy is the oh, this one last apocryphal thing, and then we should talk about it. I often heard, and I imagine some of you did also hear, the story of this monk who was being chased by a tiger, and he got trapped, and it was at the edge of a cliff, and there was nowhere for him to go, and it was clear he was going to be chased off the edge of this cliff. And over he goes to his death, and as he's falling, he notices this beautiful flower coming out of the, growing out of the rock wall of the cliff. And he's filled with joy. He's filled with appreciation of this beauty. Babes were all falling off a cliff, or really close. So let's appreciate what's in front of us. So, discuss. If you wish. Oh, he's good. He's so good. Yes.
So what came up for me while I was listening to you, I'm susceptible to my mind deceiving me because I don't know my true self that well. I'm a late bloomer to meditation. I know enough to be dangerous for my own good. But I realize how...
What do you mean by that?
It was tongue-in-cheek, but
sorry.
I realize how much I don't know.
Yeah.
And as I peel the onion back, the onion gets bigger. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. But, I don't know. There's other words for it. I like true self. And all of these layers of and it's not blame, it's not resentment, it's just the way it is that I have all these layers that are not who I am, but that I've grown up with, that I've become acclimated to, and yada, yada, yada. But that's what came up for me is this journey, this search of and yet at the same time, the reaction to grasping, the reaction to getting hooked, and then there you go again. My mindfulness teacher would say, so I got hooked again, and then being okay with that and being kind to myself about that. And then learning from it and resetting and restarting. So, and all that seems to be part of my journey of knowing myself.
I was thinking of that I teach school, and there are days I get there, and I think, oh, this child's going to be aggravating. This one was a nuisance yesterday, and I hope he does. And I have that, and I've really worked to, like, stop myself before I even get out of the car. Say, could I come in and try to start with, like, a positive attitude? Maybe things will go well today. Maybe they won't, maybe they will. But it's just very interesting, because then when you see that kid who might be challenging, you don't be like, can you sit down and get your, like the pushing, but to be like, hi, how you doing? Give him a smile. And, it doesn't work every time to get the kid on my side or whatever, but it feels much better because enough of them return the joy and the kindness that, like, the other ones are like, okay. But it's sort of interesting that if you when you come in with that sense of, like, I'm not going to get what I want, you actually pretty often are right, and because you come with that, like, you guys aren't going to do what I want. I'm like, well, of course they're not. You just told them you don't like them.
I thought of jealousy as maybe being kind of close to the victim mentality, which is what you were just saying. Oh, I'm going to somehow, it's not going to go right, and therefore I'm going to be the... So I thought about the drama triangle of that, and, maybe jealousy is more the victim. And so the other two sides of the drama triangle are the persecutor and the rescuer. I don't know how that relates or not. But, like, the victim doesn't really have a legitimate complaint. In that, when you look at it as a drama, it's just a game people... It's called games people play. So here you... Your jealousy is somehow a victim because someone's better than you or something like that. But really, truly, you don't have any real true complaint. You're just sort of ginning up this. It's a really obvious one. That's where my thoughts were at. But I was wondering about the persecutor would be, like, I'm doing this for your own good. Maybe that's aggression. I don't know. So, anyway.
It feels like this idea of joy is a big leap into letting go. And personal story, my mother died about a week ago. And it was quite sudden and unexpected. But the good news, the joyful news, is that my entire family could fly out and surround her and sing all of her favorite songs. And I've even said to some people, like, I started chanting the Tara mantra, and my whole family, who do not know this mantra, said, we really like that. And we would do it for, like, hours together.
Wow.
Around my mom, who was in a coma. But I practiced, talking to her and touching her and holding her hand and loving her up, loving her way. And my father, who is absolutely devastated, he teaches me all the time about joy. He's like, we've had such an amazing life, and I would have liked to have more of it with her. But every moment was wonderful and precious. And I saw, and I still do. I mean, this is not to say that we're all like, there's a great deal of grief and sadness that is going to be a part of perhaps a long process. But it's by raising up the light. It's about joyfully loving the possibility, the blessing that we can be together and help, hopefully, somebody, my mother, in this case, you know, go to the next wherever. Mm-hmm. And that, I think this idea of joy, because jealousy is certainly something I'm very familiar with, especially in the workplace. And I know that we're all suffering. I know that we all we're all going to die. And some of us may be more sudden and unexpected than others. Sometimes it may be long drawn out, right? And what I see in my father is just this open-hearted embracing of the pain and the joy and the everything of it. And that teaches me a lot about joy. Joy is not what I think of traditionally as joy. It's about opening up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's very very similar to what you brought up. I've forgotten your name. Tom? No.
Paul.
That whoever you are, you're never going to land on him. But your willingness to continually open, that's it. It actually, and it's very similar, because there's nothing wonderful about losing a parent or feeling like you didn't get it, but the boundless quality of the joy we're talking about, or these immeasurables, is that there's all this room to keep knowing and experiencing and having that moment of realization. So it's actually quite similar in a way, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, I was just going to, as I was thinking, because I'm Megan's husband, for those of you who don't know, so I was there too. And one thing that I just remembered as we were leaving, you know, he dropped us off at the airport, and in all his pain and grief, I can't even imagine, he said, as we were leaving today, like, he said something like, he said, in a strange way, what an amazing week it was.
Yes.
And like that.
Yes.
And that just, like, now we're talking about, yes, it's like, even in his greatest amount of grief and pain and unimaginable hurting, it looked like joy. In fact, I mean, a lot of it was that all of his kids and we came, and so like that is just like, it's just this ability for him to say that and feel it and tell us that. I mean, it's just like
extraordinary,
remarkable. So, and as I'm sitting here, it's like how, 'cause I didn't realize it, but now sitting here, it's like, how could somebody say like that? Say something like that. So he's really, and he was, yeah, I think, like he was joyful, and he was sad, he was laughing, he was crying, he was silent, he was questioning. But, you know, I've never experienced anything like this, but he was just so alive. So open.
Yeah.
And like, and, you know, it's hard to leave, but you know, stay in contact. So yeah, somehow he was able to see some light and joy, even in this darkest, probably darkest hour of his, one of the darkest, if not the darkest hour of his life. So thinking of a tone, I'm going to talk to him again. Pretty amazing what he said. I didn't realize it then, and now sitting in the context that we're talking about, it's much greater impact. So,
I think that's Anam Tupton refers to in this thing I'll hand out as that that's actually magic. Mm-hmm. That itself is actually that we get to experience.
I thought that the paragraph where he said jealousy was very obvious, I kind of didn't agree with that, really. That jealousy hides itself in judgment, and jealousy hides itself in pain. And you're telling me this reminds me of a few years ago, a colleague's husband of 60-some years passed away, and there was a huge memorial for him and a gathering afterward with this whole pictures of his life and their life and how grateful she was, and there we all were. And I have another colleague who's been through a horrible, devastating divorce and a breakup that she feels has deprived her of all the dreams that she had of a happy family. And I saw her in the room, and she was in such pain. Mm-hmm. And yes, maybe some jealousy, but she was in a lot of pain. And I went over to her and I said, "Are you having a hard time with this?" And she said, "No." So jealousy is can be very, why do they have that dress? I want that. But jealousy can be rooted in some real hard experiences that we have. And to somehow you have to go deeper and tease out, why am I judging this person so harshly? Well, you know, maybe it's not always obvious to you. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So.
So I'm going to actually take a different turn on this, which is I've been experiencing a year of immense blessings, which just seem out of the ordinary. And my struggle has been to not cling to them, to hold on to impermanence, and be ready to let go of wherever this is all coming from. And it's been a challenge, because it's easy to start to make it concrete. Mm-hmm. Just as I've been through a year of devastating tragedy, and there was a lot of work in letting go of that, I'm finding the same is on this end, where all this incredible good luck, is good fortune is coming down, and I'm working hard to go, okay, let go. And actually something that you read, which was a big light bulb for me, which was, I think that the antidote to that is to stop making it about me.
Yeah, exactly.
And my blessings. And it's also because our family's going through this. Our family, for whatever reason, has just been, like some families go through, like, all this. Our family's just been having tons of good things happening for this year. So we're all just going, whoa, what's happening? Yeah. So what he's saying, and I think is the practice has to be, is step outside of us. It's not about us. And I have been feeling kind of like I'm a passenger on this really big ocean. I really don't know what's going on and where it's going. And I'm just like, hey, look, that's kind of cool. But still, I've got to look at, there's everyone else on the ocean, too. You know, we're all on the ocean. It's not just me there. And to that, the interdependence, of everybody and everything, I have to keep that in mind. Let go of it being that it's my fault.
Or solidifying yourself as separate. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
Which freezes everything.
Yes, yes.
And then you hit an iceberg.
Yeah. But on top of that, it's like I'm looking at what's going on in my life, and I'm looking at what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And there's this immense disparity, and I'm just like, how do I manage that disparity? So it's almost this weird opposite of jealousy, where you're in a lot of pain and you see the joy going on around you and you want it, and then the opposite of that is you have a lot of joy going on and you're looking at all this insanity going on.
How do we live with that dichotomy?
Yes. And so I try doing breathing out the joy to humanity and wishing joy, just like, you know, wishing relief of suffering. But it's not easy. I kind of thought I'd have a little more skill at it before, but this has been a challenge. But I think that comment was really a big light bulb for me, which is it's just let go of me for this while.
Do you think that, or do we think, or I think, let's just say that. Thank you. That really there's supposed to be a happy ending still. Like there's supposed to be a point at which everything works out fine.
Yeah. Forever after.
Everything's great.
I used to think that.
Yeah, but it's so subtle just for me. I think I keep it, again, it keeps coming up. It's a little bit of like, which again is solidifying me and I and other. Like I'm not, it's part of solidifying. Mm. And it's a theistic view, actually, that I think is very... So anyway,
or a fate, maybe not even theistic, but like it's fated this, and the biggest attachment that can happen is this false belief that I am responsible for all these.
Oh
boy, that's and it's so attractive to think that, like I caused this to happen. Right. And if you want to follow that, then you darn well better follow that all the tragedy that's happening in you, as well as your fault too. So it's just like, watch that one.
Yeah. I thought of something, I think coming up to what Megan was saying, that the thing about joy, that being like totally open, undefended, is that I think joy never, it's never... pure or unilateral. It's comes with so many other. Like you have to be open. There's joy, and then there's pain, and then there's all sorts of other feelings. But to expect or cling to the other pain, just the joy that then blocks the joy.
Yeah.
But just sort of this open stream that lets the joy in. It's going to be there amid the pain or the anger or whatever shit is going on.
So that's
well said.
That's very much like what Anand Tupton says at the end of this handout, which you're going to get. It says, like you see this beautiful sunset, and you're filled with this surprise and joy of it, and you go to get your smartphone to take a picture.
Yeah.
And it's gone by the time you got your... So that's what...
Yeah,
beautiful.
Because we want to make something that's temporary and permanent.
Yeah.
And I mean, photography is guilty as charged in that one. You know,
just be the only one.
I must be. But I was just thinking, it really comes down to temporary and interconnected. Really, it's that's what open is. It's truly believing that this moment is temporary, and we are all interconnected.
It's heartbreakingly beautiful, isn't it?
And simple, but boy, do we make it complex.
Well, we have one more minute, guys.
So I wanted to share that my great joy was like I was working with a young woman who came, and when I walked in here for the meditation, there was just such joy just to be with this group of people doing stuff. And it was like, even if nothing else happened, just to come in the room. And that's kind of a, to do that. And to see a lot of people we haven't seen.